Thank you all for coming. I'm Simon Hicks, Professor of Political Science in the Government Department here at the LSE. Welcome to this LSE Government Department and British Government at LSE event. The hashtag for the event, not up on the screen here, hashtag is LSECLEG, if you're into Twitter. Nick will be signing books, and books are for sale afterwards outside in the foyer if you want to stay afterwards. So let me say a few words about our guest this evening. Nick Clegg needs no introduction, really, and I'll keep it very brief, and I'll try and say a few things you might not know about Nick. Nick, of course, was elected to the European Parliament in 1999 and then to the House of Commons in 2005. He became leader of the Liberal Democrats in 2007 and in May 2010 became Deputy Prime Minister in the first coalition government in peacetime in the UK since the 1930s. Coalition, of course, was a noble endeavour, as he explains in his book, as it allowed government to function during a deep economic crisis and remarkably lasted the full 5 years despite sceptics at the time. And I remember being on a platform in this room with a panel of political scientists trying to predict how long the coalition would last, and I think the median prediction was a year. So you certainly proved us all wrong. Nick resigned as leader of the Liberal Democrats following what I expect will be regarded by historians as unfair punishment of the party in 2015. Most of you will know this. Now let me say a few things about Nick you might not know. Nick speaks English, French, Dutch, German and Spanish. I bet there aren't many British politicians who can claim that. Nick is one of the most well-connected politicians in Europe, having studied at the College of Europe in Bruges and then as a young MEP with a cohort of future European leaders, including Helle Thorning-Schmidt, former Danish Prime Minister, Cecilia Malmström, current EU Trade Commissioner, Lucevice van der Laan, the current parliamentary leader of the Dutch D66, and Michiel van Hulten, the former president of the Dutch Labour Party, and many others, no doubt. I first met Nick when I was researching the European Parliament, and he was a young MEP, and I remember he was the rapporteur on the Local Loop Unbundling Directive, which sounds very dull, but actually Nick led a coalition of MEPs to block governments, or to force governments to open up the last mile of telecommunications all across Europe. So thank you to Nick Clegg, MEP. We all across Europe have very cheap internet access. So a huge victory for consumers. Thank you, Nick. Anyway, enough from me. We're all here to hear Nick talk about his book, which for me is probably the best book by a British senior politician since Roy Hattersley's Choose Freedom in 1987, but that's my own taste for these types of things. So over to you. Nick and I were talking beforehand, and we thought we'd have a conversation for about half an hour, and then we'll open it up for questions from the audience. And we're going to talk about three topics. We're going to talk first about the coalition, the formation of the coalition, and perhaps how things might have been different, whether he regrets some of the things that happened during the coalition and the formation. And then we'll move on and we'll talk about his views on the state of British politics right now. In the book, Nick calls for a government of national unity, I think he calls it, and some interesting ideas about the future of liberal politics or the liberal centre in Britain. And then finally, we'll move on to Brexit, which of course he only touches a little bit in the book because most of the book, I assume, was written before 23rd of June. But I already see on Twitter half an hour ago, a lot of you in the audience want to hear about Nick's views on Brexit. So he, I'm sure, will be able to rant on about that as much as he likes. But so let's start off talking about the coalition. So if we roll back to 2010, a lot of people are still saying, why did you prop up the Tories? Why did you not go into government with Labour? And you try to kind of answer that in the book, but I think there's a lot of people here asking that. So what's your explanation?
Because there was no arithmetical combination of Liberal Democrat and Labour MPs which constituted a majority. But it's interesting you say that, or you say that still, I mean, I still have people say to me, you know, as if it was a sort of eeny, meeny, miny, mo decision, sort of, should we, you know, Gordon Brown or David Cameron, how do I feel, sort of plucking petals from a sort of flat. It wasn't like that. There was absolutely no viable Labour-Liberal Democrat combination. And even though we explained at the time, even though it was arithmetically obvious, even though that's exactly what the seat said, it's interesting that still people say, you know, why don't you go with your heart rather than your head sort of thing. So actually the decision was not Labour or Conservative. There was, as you may remember, a short period of time where Gordon Brown sought to persuade me, and indeed others, that a what he called a rainbow coalition of Labour, Liberal Democrats, Plaid, SNP, Green, Motley, some of the Northern Irish MPs, motley tapestry of MPs could constitute a government. And
but isn't that what you're now arguing for in your book?
Well, I'll come to that. I accept the challenge that I felt then and would feel again, that having experienced how tricky it is sometimes to keep two parties on the straight and narrow over 5 years, the idea of trying to sort of corral, I mean, it really would be like herding cats. Anyway, so I made it very clear to Gordon Brown, as, by the way, did most of his own team. I mean, he was about the only person in the Labour Party who thought that that was a viable approach, that it was just absolutely nonsensical. So the decision really for the Liberal Democrats wasn't, you know, left or right. It was government or no government. And I felt then, and I still feel now, and certainly the Liberal Democrats as a whole, as a party, because, you know, the Liberal Democrats especially, but political parties are not sects. I mean, this is not a sort of decision that I just suddenly made one Tuesday morning and woke up and said, oh, I think I might do a coalition with the Conservatives, you know. We talked about this exhaustively, and we had endless late-night discussions. We even rented, I remember, a vast sort of aircraft hangar-style building in Birmingham somewhere to assemble and to vote on it. And the vast, vast, vast majority, only a tiny number of Liberal Democrats, voted against it. So it was a collective decision, and I thought it was the right decision then. I thought it was the right decision now because, memories are short, but there was a real feeling that because the aftershocks of the 2008 crisis were only then really starting to be felt in their real brutality, there was a real feeling that without stable government, the economy would have gone into a bit of a tailspin, and I believe that to be true, and I think it was necessary to provide a degree of political stability, which the government did, whilst governments all over Europe were sort of falling like ninepins. So that was the decision was not Gordon or Dave. It was coalition with the Conservatives, our erstwhile opponents, or sort of saying, oh well, you know, we've got the chance to govern, but we're so worried about our own, we're sort of so precious about our own fate that
you didn't consider the supporting them as a minority government from the back benches, as you said. If the choice was not Labour versus Conservative, if the choice was going to forming a formal coalition with them and having ministerial portfolios and sitting around a cabinet table, versus conditionally supporting from the back benches and agreeing a very limited set of things you'd support them on, and perhaps then precipitating an earlier election and a different sort of outcome.
Yeah, no, that's what they call in the jargon confidence and supply. So you give them you provide backing to a government at the outset for the finance bills, for the budgets, and you give them support through a confidence and supply arrangement for a few other priorities. I personally think that's the worst of all worlds, because it would have meant that we would have been giving explicit political support for all the controversial stuff to do with the fiscal consolidation, which was self-evidently going to offend a lot of our traditional supporters, not most especially those employed in the public sector. So we would have kind of got all the opprobrium from that quarter, which any government was going to get, certainly any government leaning to the centre-left. I mean, centre-left parties, but perhaps most especially a centre-left party in a coalition with a larger right or centre-right party, and that's bad enough. But doing that at a time of fiscal crisis is a pretty unforgiving thing to do. So we would have reaped all the opprobrium for that, and absolutely none of the ability to also implement reforms. You know, Steve Webb's reforms on pensions, Danny's on the income tax allowance, Vince's on apprenticeships, the stuff that Ed Davey and Chris Hume did on the green. I mean, these weren't small things. These were major, major reforms, some of which are now being undone. So, no, I felt then and still feel now that giving support, in a sense, to all the controversial stuff, but then sort of not daring to kind of take responsibility and actually grip the levers of government on the rest of the stuff would have been the worst of both worlds. That was my view.
So then reasonably you agree then to sit around a cabinet table to draft a coalition agreement, And you agreed to what is quite a short coalition statement, and in comparative European terms, a very quick agreement, and a very particular model of coalition government, which is where you doubled up ministries.
Yeah.
The alternative model would have been actually to say, these are Lib Dem ministries and these are Conservative ministries.
Yeah.
And yourself, you know, taking a role as Deputy Prime Minister, where without portfolio, in a sense, without a major Ministry of State, whereas we look around examples of coalition governments in Europe, and the standard tradition is either to take Foreign Secretary or Chancellor or one of the other major offices of state. And in hindsight, do you think that what you've learned, maybe next time round, or in hindsight, would you have done it differently in terms of thinking about the design of the coalition?
Not much, except for one possibility, which you've just hinted at, which I'll come to in a minute. But look, I spent quite a lot of time talking to some of the European politicians I know that you alluded to earlier, some of whom had experienced coalition government themselves. I remember speaking to the leader of the Swedish Liberals, and the Swedish Liberals have over years now sort of established education as their fiefdom, and then the rest of government is entirely sort of untouched by their influence. The FDP in Germany traditionally kind of occupied foreign policy and left the rest of the government to other parties. The sort of control freak in me wouldn't have particularly liked the idea of just being in a little balkanised bit of Whitehall and allowing the Conservatives to do exactly what they want in the rest of Whitehall. But much more importantly than that, we just don't have the coalition culture in this country which would compute the idea that, you know, politics is sort of, the government is sort of segmented like a cake, and that cake slice goes to that lot. So I thought then, and would again repeat that if it were to come to it, that it was better to show that it was a partnership government, to have Liberal Democrat ministers across all departments, and to ensure, which is why I had to be Deputy Prime Minister, to ensure that I had my hands free of day-to-day departmental work, just as David Cameron did, so that David Cameron and I, in a sense, were both free to kind of play the role, which we did over 5 years, through thick and thin, of kind of being the sort of clearinghouse, if you like, at the top of government for all the things that bubble up every day, and constantly resolving the differences that would regularly occur between Liberal Democrat and Conservative ministers. So I think, you know, I think it made sense that if it was going to be something new, which the British Parliament, the Whitehall, and certainly the British press were really struggling to understand, we had to kind of say, you know, this is a partnership government. That famous or infamous Rose Garden moment was a very clear demonstration of a partnership government, two leaders running a government that is normally run by one individual and one party, and that had to sort of prevail across Whitehall. The exception I would make, but not that I think it was readily available to us, it would have been to take the Treasury. Because Whitehall is so ludicrously centralised, and the Treasury is such a sort of, you know, spider at the centre of the Whitehall web, I think that you know, if that was a possibility, then I would probably stop thinking, because you can, in a sense, you can have the same, you can deliver the same effect, but it's the same ambition. You're trying to make sure there is symmetry across the piece. Margaret Vestager, for a time occupied the sort of economics ministry in the Danish coalition with Helle Thorning-Schmidt, and she's one of the very, very few leaders of a smaller coalition party who, for a while, it didn't last, but for a while, because she was able to exercise that sort of day-to-day economic authority, she didn't suffer the fate that leaders of pretty well every other smaller party in coalition across Europe.
You weren't a smaller party, in a sense, compared to most of those.
Yeah.
I mean, you had 20-something percent of the vote. You had actually a couple of million votes short of the Conservatives.
Yeah.
So, in a sense, you were, at that point, in perhaps a much stronger position negotiating than perhaps in hindsight looking back now.
Yeah, I think that's a fair.
You know, when you look at it, and you admit in the book that by doubling up on all the ministries,
then
the Conservatives end up claiming credit for all the things that actually Lib Dems are responsible for. So, for example, pupil premium, raising the threshold before people start paying tax, marriage equality.
Yeah.
I mean, we heard David Cameron in his retirement speech claiming all these things that were essentially Lib Dem policies.
I know.
The things he's most proud about of what they achieved in government.
Thanks, Dave. Yeah.
But that
sort of problem of sort of policy kleptomania, where people sort of where they kind of just they sort of they sort of took all the stuff that, that we'd worked up, if it sort of shimmered and shined and was popular, and then paraded those on. That's not solved by whether you take one department or you're, that's not solved at all, because the problem there is a related problem, which is that if you've got absolutely no vested interest anywhere in the kind of echo chamber of politics, particularly but not exclusively in the newspaper industry, in fact quite the reverse, you know, the Liberal Democrats very successfully united life left and right in sort of breathless opprobrium over the, you know, sort of Polly Toynbee and Paul Dacre became indistinguishable in their sort of vituperation about the Liberal Democrats, if from completely opposite ideological points of view. It meant that even if we secured these great advances, which we did, and it's, you know, I sort of detail some of it in the book, you know, bluntly, if no one is interested in telling your story, you can tell it yourself as much as you like, and as I again describe in the book, after a while, realising that I was blocked from getting our message across in Parliament or through the mainstream media, I spent all my time trying to do different things to communicate, I don't know, phone-in programmes on the LBC, public meetings in halls like this up and down the country. Self-evidently didn't work, but that problem of just not having a sort of trampoline, if I can put it that way, for our, yeah, for our, I'm mixing metaphors of echo chambers and trampolines, but you know what I mean, for our ideas. If you don't have that, it kind of almost doesn't matter which department you're in or how you've shuffled the pack in Whitehall. If it's just not refracted beyond Whitehall, well, people don't hear it.
Okay. So looking back at the achievements, at some of the achievements you've mentioned, surely one of the major failures from a Liberal Democrat point of view was political reform.
Yeah, definitely.
It was, you know, no House of Lords,
yep,
election, no reform.
All right, stop rubbing it in. Yeah, no, it was it.
Would you have done things differently on those sorts of issues?
Well, look,
one chance.
Well, no, I mean, answers on a postcard. I mean, because, you know, of course I've thought of it. First, I agree with you. It's the thing I probably regret more than anything else. I mean, there are plenty of other things to regret, but because, you know, as I describe in the book, and again, it's very difficult to remember this now because politics has changed so much. I mean, heaven's sake, it's changed so much in the last few months, yet alone the last several years. But if you cast your mind back to 2010, the reason why the coalition, at the beginning at least, felt like kind of the right government for the right circumstances at the right time was that it was born of two major crises, or rather it was created to respond to two major crises. One, the financial crisis in 2008 and its economic and financial consequences, and second, the aftermath of the MPs' expenses scandal. And David Cameron and I were very sort of explicit in understanding that the glue of the coalition at the outset was that so the Liberal Democrats would bring kind of the reforming zeal to sort of change politics, which the Conservatives would not sign up to hook, line and sinker, but they'd kind of, you know, the coalition would give at least the space to finally land some of these reforms. And we would together deliver the kind of gory job of starting to stabilise the banking system and the public finances and so on. And in effect, what happened was that glue, that symmetry, which bound the two parties together in a pretty balanced way at the beginning, over time gave way to a totally unbalanced arrangement where basically neither the Conservative nor the Labour Party, so the two big vested interests who always block political reform, did so all over again and neutered everything from party funding reform, House of Lords reform, electoral reform. But we broadly stuck to the deal on kind of fiscal on the fiscal job. So, you know, I suppose you could. It's not something that really readily occurred to me because I think sort of going off in a huff is not a particularly sensible thing to do in politics or in life. But yeah, I mean, I remember at one point saying to Cameron, you know, the problem for us was we were governing in the latter part of that parliament with a completely different party to the one we'd started the coalition with. We started the coalition with this nice, shiny, cuddly, husky, whatever you call it,
hugger hoodie,
compassionate conservative and cared about the environment and cared about social justice and was interested in political reform. You know, fast forward to the end of the parliament, you had a conservative leader increasingly harried and captive to, or hostage to his right wing on Europe, on immigration, ranting against any environmental measures, skewering any political reform. And look, the when you ask, I mean, I've read some sort of critics. I mean, I just find it so extraordinary they can say this. Saying, you know, the biggest failure was Nick Clegg didn't deliver electoral reform when he could have done. It's like, it's not my magic wand. It was a referendum, for heaven's sake. You know, it's not, it's like, and you can't deliver big constitutional reform other than by persuading one or other of the big vested interests that have traditionally blocked reform. And I thought I'd had the Conservatives more on the hook than, of course, turned out to be the case. But the lesson, which is not an easy one, is, you know, we've, in my view, constitutional reform, radical constitutional reform, or painful constitutional reform for that old duopoly, will only really happen when one or the other of them finally doesn't just pay lip service to it, because they had House of Lords reform in both their manifestos. Labour actually had AV in their manifesto, not in the Lib Dem manifesto or even the Conservative manifesto. So the thing on the ballot paper in the referendum was a Labour proposal. And they did absolutely nothing, to put it politely, to actually deliver the votes at that time. So you just have to somehow persuade one or other of the other two larger parties to bite the bullet. Otherwise, it's extremely difficult for any other participant in politics to break the logjam, is my view. But, you know.
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the tuition fees.
Yep.
So, an audience of students.
I don't think you'd be remiss,
parents.
Actually. I don't think you would at all, but, you know, if you must.
So, what's your take on it now, looking back, and the whole, you know, the from Clegg mania through to Clegg hatred as tuition fees and the big demonstrations and the caricatures and people still talking now about being let down and lied to and all the rest of it? I mean, what's your take on that? And do you think that the punishment of the party 5 years later at the polls was in part at least to what happened of the debate about tuition fees?
Well, first let me say something surprising. I don't actually think that's the case. I think we would have got punished anyway.
Right.
And if it wasn't tuition fees, it would have been, I don't know, the bedroom tax or something else would have been used as a sort of symbol of our heinous, you know, perfidious behaviour. And unfortunately, the pattern, I describe this in the book, the pattern is time and time and time again that smaller parties in coalitions in Europe get hammered just as much, if not more so, than we were last year. And they didn't do tuition fees. So I just think it's far too simplistic to say. I think this sense of anger, frustration, disappointment, betrayal, I think tuition fees became the kind of shorthand way of describing that, understandably so. But I actually think that would have existed possibly with just as much force. And something else would have exemplified. On the policy itself, look, I mean,
you're very candid.
Yeah, listen, I can't write a book without you know, being candid about this stuff for obvious reasons. It was a mix of things. It was partly the inability of me and Vince and David Laws and Danny Alexander in the leadership of the party in the run-up to the 2010 election. It was our failure to persuade our party of what we felt very strongly, which was that, yes, it was a politically attractive thing to say, but it was completely unrealistic. And actually not really, it didn't actually bear that much scrutiny on grounds of sort of liberalism and progressive liberalism either. Because, you know, you've got to remember, it is a massive subsidy, free tuition, from lots and lots of people who haven't benefited from university education to those who do. It's, you know, if you want to do something really progressive in education, I've always felt this, you should shovel all that money not into a sort of cross subsidy to those people who go to university. You'd be shoveling all that money, which, by the way, we did a lot in the government, to early years education for the poorest kids. That all the evidence shows that's the best way to develop social mobility. But anyway, look, whether that was the case or not, Vince, who was our economic spokesperson, felt very strongly that it was not affordable. We spent a long time trying to kind of shift the policy. We failed. The party correctly and collectively decided to stick with the commitment, well, with some fiddles. And so the first error was to go into an election with a policy that pretty well everybody at the senior echelons of the party just didn't believe was deliverable. That was the first error, for which we got found out and punished. Second error, obviously, was to then say, you know, when we will commit to doing everything to delivering this policy when we'd spent so much time trying to shift it in the first place. Third dilemma was that both the two larger parties agreed with each other more than they did with the Liberal Democrats on the issue of tuition fees. I mean, people readily forget, and it's very nice for Labour to forget this, but of course they introduced fees, and given the sanctimony with which they condemned us for increasing fees, they actually then increased it despite their own manifesto commitment a few years earlier not to do so. And so and then, of course, they'd commissioned the Brown Review. Peter Mandelson did that. He produced a report which advocated no upper limit at all, never mind 9,000. So we were completely without leverage, because we couldn't say to the Tories, you know, you must do this because lots of people in Parliament believe this, because they knew that the Labour had introduced them, increased them, and wanted to increase them again. So we had absolutely no leverage. So you've got this concatenation of things that senior party leaders didn't really believe in it fully, that we couldn't deliver it in the coalition agreement. So, of course, then what Vince ended up doing was the next best thing, designing the system we've got. I think it's been... I think it's been significantly made more aggressive because of what the conversion from grants to loans for living expenses. And the final sort of tragedy in all of this was perhaps naivety, because of the doubts that I had and Vince had and others about the policy, we, other than that very fateful photograph of the pledge card in Cambridge, we barely campaigned on it at all in 2010. I know history is rewritten to suggest that's all we went on about. Absolutely not true at all. And more than that, we decided to put completely different priorities on the front page of our Lib Dem manifesto. So the pupil premium, raising the personal income tax allowance, cleaning up the economic mess, and political reform. Very, very deliberately not accentuating a policy which was a subject of difference within the Lib Dems. Anyway, look, that's the genealogy of that policy and what ended up happening. But, you know, people nonetheless sort of, you know, felt that it was an iconic policy, the rest is history, which they felt very angry about that it wasn't delivered.
So let's roll forward a bit to the election 2015 and decimation of the party, really. I mean, what's your take now on, would the campaign have been different? Could you have done anything different? What's your reading of what actually happened in 2015?
Well, first, I bridle a little at all these sort of flat earth terms of decimation. I mean, 2.5 million people voted for the Liberal Democrats last year, even at the lowest point of our fortunes. I mean, that is a million more than voted for the SNP. People forget this. A million more people voted for the Lib Dems last year than the SNP. It's just because we've got this insane electoral system that they get 56 MPs and everyone thinks they're sort of strutting their stuff. And even though we get a million more votes, we get 8. And I think, you know, it'll be much more than 2.5 million, a bit much more than 2.5 million next time. We're already recovering. We will recover. Do I think the election campaign itself... Well, at the beginning of the election campaign, the kind of stance that we decided to take, which was always in danger of being a bit of a sort of appearing as a slightly insipid split the difference refrain, but it was nonetheless one that we knew was the most appealing sort of refrain which we had available to us at that stage. Was a voice of moderation and restraint, either on the Conservatives or Labour, and that actually made sense at the beginning of the campaign. I cannot tell you what an electric effect the Conservative and Conservative Party supporting press's campaign had when they latched onto this Miliband salmon thing. It absolutely changed the landscape dramatically, because it meant for wavering voters or voters who didn't feel very strong in their political affiliation or tactical voters, it had an electric effect on them. You know, I'll let you into a little secret. Most political parties, most of the time these days, devote quite a lot of effort into trying to work out how people vote when they vote postally, because that happens about 10 days or so before the election itself. And more people are voting postally. They tend to be a bias to older voters and so on. But, you know, and how do we do that? We do that, but we do endless canvassing, telephone canvassing, and they say we're going to vote postally. Then after the postal vote deadline, we go back to them, we ask them how they vote. So we have a pretty good idea about where things are going in the last week of the campaign. And seat after seat after seat, particularly in the southwest, we were either even Stevens with the Conservative Party, or in some cases, I mean, I know that in David Laws's case, he felt they were like 3 or 4 points ahead. Something happened in those last few. I'm not pretending it's all because of that, but I do think that it was a devastatingly effective tactic for the Conservatives to say to wavering voters, look, and they did it. They did it very well as well. I mean, you know, I saw some of the letters. You had these sort of beautifully designed letters sent from some central dispatching office here in London to you know, Mrs. Miggins in 36 Orchard Close in Devon, saying, you know, we know you're a Liberal Democrat, and we like the Liberal Democrats, we governed with them very nicely for 5 years, terribly nice people, but, you know, this time, I'm afraid, could you just lend us your vote, because really, you know, it's time for the sort of big boys to look after the United Kingdom, because, you know, that dastardly Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon, they might run amok and play, you know, puppeteer to a sort of hapless Ed Miliband in Number 10. And it absolutely electrified the last stages of the... And we had no answer to it. We had no answer to it at all. There was no Lib Dem. So we were an answer to voters' concerns that they were worried that either Labour was not reliable on the economy or the Conservatives were not socially progressive enough. We were at least an answer. Whether we were a compelling answer or not is a different matter. But at least we had a plausible answer. We weren't an answer to the fear that somehow Ed Miliband was going to be, you know, a puppet on Alex Salmond's string. We weren't the answer to that. The Conservatives were. Of course they were.
But you're very critical in the book of the SNP. And, you know, I was sat on this platform and chaired Nicola Sturgeon when she came to speak here. I mean, she strikes me as a very sort of liberal, progressive politician. And actually what they've done in Scotland is not that dissimilar in policy terms to the type of things you'd want to see in England. And at some point, surely the liberal, progressive left in Britain is going to have to come to terms with the SNP as a major force and do business with them. So kind of painting them as a evil, nasty, terrible force of people who hate the English, surely that was that came back to bite you, I think, in the election.
Well, I've never said that.
And you will have to do business with them, and you admit in the book you want some broad coalition. Sure. And, you know, so why be so critical of the SNP?
Because I'm very critical of nationalism and chauvinism. I think it's a real blight on democratic debate across the developed world. And however nice they might be, or progressive some of their policies, chauvinism and nationalism is what it is. It is a divisive political philosophy, which is almost the antithesis, in my book, to what liberalism is about. Liberalism is not about building walls, creating divisions, splitting nations, dividing communities. So the premise of nationalism is one I've got the problem with, not with Nicola Sturgeon personally. I happen to think they're not nearly as progressive as they pretend they are north of the border, but yeah, right, some of the policies I agree with, some of them I don't. They're actually turning out to be a rather illiberal centralising party in many ways in Holyrood. But that's not my beef with them. My beef is nationalism. Is that beef the wrong... Okay. Someone finds beef funny, but anyway, you know what I mean. My objection is to nationalism.
Okay,
I think nationalism is a form of populist political philosophy. Because, and I'll tell you why, and why there is something. I think there's something umbilically in common between Scottish nationalism, Catalonian nationalism, the nationalism in Flanders and elsewhere, and other forms, other more lurid forms of populism, because they all, in one shape or form, say, we feel your anger, we understand your grievance, we share your pain, and you know what? It's someone else's fault. That's what they do. However they dress it up, however sophisticated Nicola Sturgeon may be, that is the core of the philosophy. And I abhor that, because I think nothing is more illiberal, in my view, than the politics of grievance, saying that complex problems, many of which of our own making, have to be somebody else's fault. And if only if only Antwerp splits from Brussels, Barcelona splits from Madrid, Edinburgh splits from London, build a wall against the Mexicans, pull out of the European Union. It's all the same refrain. It's giving people a false sense of security by saying you can kind of pull out of things, get off the world, get off the kind of treadmill of the world. And I don't agree with it.
But you are in favour of quite radical decentralisation of policies and a kind of liberal view of autonomy and accountability for local decisions. And, you know, so an element of that you would agree with in terms of decentralising power.
But here's the irony. The nationalists, when left to their own devices north of the border, are not being decentralisers at all. They're not being decentralised. I mean, it's really important, this. I think Nicola Sturgeon is clearly a highly gifted politician, and she has she's made Scottish nationalism, I think, much more acceptable, palatable, even attractive, particularly to progressive voters who feel disenchanted with what's happening south of the border. But I have to say to you, my rather uncompromising message would be, don't be fooled. Nationalism is nationalism, however it's clothed and however it's camouflaged.
So let's move on and talk about the state of British politics now. You're writing a book about liberalism. In a sense, the book could be about the strange death of liberalism in Britain, given where we are in British politics. We've got a Conservative Party that potentially is the furthest right it's been for probably anybody's memory in British politics, and a Labour Party that's perhaps further left than it even was in 1983 under Corbyn's leadership, and a gaping hole in the middle, and yet doesn't seem that many voters really want to be there in the middle. So I mean, you know, how does a Liberal, what is the Liberal strategy or centrist strategy from here in terms of rebuilding a centrist coalition?
Well, I think the first question to ask is that the right way to think of politics, the sort of traditional right, left, middle? And I'm not sure it is, and as I explain in the book, I think those old right, left sort of tribal definitions, which were rooted in the sort of primeval conflicts of communism versus capitalism, the ideological debates about market versus state, public versus private, the bosses versus the workers, the north versus the south, that polarized world, which I suspect, looking around, most of us sort of grew up in, and that's certainly the kind of politics I grew up with, is now giving way, and I think this is what was revealed so starkly in the referendum, by, in many ways, divisions and a sort of fracture, and a sort of cultural distinction, which isn't about left-right, actually. It's about open, closed. It's about whether people feel secure or insecure. It's whether people feel optimistic or pessimistic. And I think that's kind of transcending the left-right stuff. And my own view, and I sort of try and grapple with this perhaps imperfectly in the final chapter of the book, is that if the politics of moderation, of reason, is going to kind of make a comeback against this increasingly shrill, vituperative, loud, kind of slanging match on right and left, then we've got to work out a way of providing reassurance and a kind of sort of a sense of security, a sense that, you know, life isn't constantly threatening many of our, you know, many millions of our fellow citizens. And for me, the explanation for that profound anxiety has more to do with, you know, everything from a lack of affordable housing to a lack of decent social care to stagnant wages since 2008 to, you know, grotesque differences, both geographical and wealth differentials across society. So, oddly enough, I think the lesson both for centre-ground politics but also for actually everybody after the Brexit referendum is not so much what are the terms of the negotiation between David Davis and Mr. Barnier. It's what are we going to do about these kind of running sores that have really aggravated people, on housing, on pay, on the kind of basic elemental ingredients that make up for a more secure life than many people have at the moment. And if we don't do that as sort of centre-ground politicians, we'll always... Because, look, we're living through an era of fear. Fear is the dominant emotion for a lot of people at the moment. Fear about violence, fear about extremism, fear about globalisation, fear about losing their jobs, fear about what's happening to their kids. And liberalism is, generally speaking, a philosophy that doesn't do fear very well. Or rather, it doesn't address fear very well, because it's a kind of optimistic creed. It's an Enlightenment philosophy. It believes that tomorrow is always better than yesterday. It believes in science. It believes in evidence. It believes in progress.
It believes in experts.
Yeah, it believes in experts. But, kind of liberalism kind of has a slight feeling there's a kind of linear line of progress. That's not how many people feel at the moment. And so I think what liberals need to do is ask themselves really tough questions about how we can rewire the economy, rewire the way that cake is divided up so that people feel more secure. If people don't feel secure, and fear is the dominant emotion, they'll always go to the populists on right and left.
So do you hope the Labour Party splits?
I mean, look, I think the problem with the Labour Party... If I was Labour, I wouldn't recommend it, because, you know, splittism never works in politics. But I think the problem for Labour, in my view, is a little bit more fundamental than that right now. In my view, they can never win again, right? They cannot win power again. Unless you think they're going to beat the SNP in Scotland or beat the Conservatives in England. And that has very profound implications for all of us, because it means that the basic kind of pendulum mechanism of our democracy has stopped. Right? And that's dangerous, because it means you've now got a government almost accidentally in power, with a prime minister without her mandate, doing radical things to our country. Look at what she announced about selection and education, without any mandate to do so. Having her party, however, having secured, barely 24% of the eligible vote last year. And what the Conservatives have worked out, I don't think it was a deliberate conspiracy, I think it kind of, they can't believe their luck, is that because the Scottish Nationalists have kneecapped their principal opponents north of the border, and as long as they keep the electoral system the way it is, and as long as the money keeps flowing in from their financiers in the City of London, and as long as the Mail and the Telegraph and the Times and the Sun and all these papers line up to support them as ferociously as they do at election time, they don't really need to do much more than cater to, not exclusively, but largely elderly English voters. And hey presto, they can stay in power over and over again. Now that's really dangerous because it's lopsided, it's unrepresentative, it allows for sort of partial government in which the whole United Kingdom is kind of basically dancing to the tune of a sort of small segment of political opinion. In one shape or form, the only way to restore balance to that is in my view, if there is some kind of cooperation, realignment maybe in the long run, of parties that want to provide a winning offer to the British people. But you're going to have to as well deal with the three big blockages that I've alluded to. Scottish nationalism, basically now running a one-party fiefdom in Scotland. Very powerful vested interests in the press, who now basically run amok without any real sort of counterbalance. Because, you know, The Guardian, bless its cotton socks, has become such a sort of curdled, introverted, you know, it sort of talks to itself rather than actually puts up a challenge. well, as does the Labour Party. So what I mean is, you know, you've got, you know, the Barclay brothers, Paul Dacre, Murdoch, they can basically, you know, they're unchallenged as sort of vested interests in the press. So you've got the SNP, you've got the press vested interest, and you've got the system, the system which allows the Conservatives to hoover up huge amounts of money and only require 24%. So one way or another, you have to find some new constellation that challenges some or all of those three blockages. And if that doesn't happen, yeah, we're going to be stuck with this for a while.
So strategically, should the Liberal Democrats be thinking about some kind of cross-party anti-Tory electoral pact?
Well,
that then says we'll... You know, what's the content of this government of
sure.
national unity? And is it, you know, they stand on a platform, we will introduce PR and then dissolve the parliament and have an election under PR? I mean, what's the content of this?
I'll come to it in a minute. Can I just, on PR, and in keeping with what I said earlier, the moment where I'll suddenly start thinking, wow, things might change in British politics, is if the Labour Party starts advocating electoral reform and does so seriously. That's the next big turn of the wheel that needs to happen. Now, it so happens to be, in my view...
They did before 97.
Well, they did before... a variant of it, exactly. But I not only think it's the right thing for the country, for all the reasons you'll be familiar with, I actually happen to think it's absolutely indispensable for Labour's own survival. Because, you know, Labour's not going to survive very long if it keeps losing an election in a system where it can't win, or at least not survive as a kind of viable party of government. So I actually think it is massively in Labour's interest. But the reason why I think it's so important that Labour should come to that realisation is because they can't win on their own, they've got to understand if they want to administer power, it will only ever be on the basis of shared power. And shared power is best done through an electoral system which encourages that and allows the diversity and fragmented diversity of political opinion to express itself in a way that the first-past-the-post system doesn't. So that's just on that point. In terms of the how, my crystal ball is no clearer than others. I just have a very strong intuition that if you analyse these kind of big blocks, if you analyse the structures, the lopsided structures of British politics now, the only way out of that is in some shape or form through some kind of restructuring of non-conservative forces in British politics. How it might happen, I don't know. I mean, in the book, what I suggest is a rather specific scenario, and it's based on my view that this government is going to get into terrible, terrible trouble over the next two or three years. And I think, in an odd way, Theresa May's rather sort of methodical demeanour, if I can put it like that, is sort of flattering to deceive. It's giving the impression to everybody, it's business as usual. Actually, this government is skating on very thin ice. You have this profound, no doubt come to it, this profound argument still raging between those conservatives who prioritise open markets and free trade and those who prioritise a sort of vision of sort of gunboat diplomacy, 19th century parliamentary sovereignty. And they are in direct conflict with each other, and it will have to come to the surface on Brexit, because you can't have one... You either have both. You can't have, you know, one without the other, if you know what I mean. And so I think they're going to get into terrible trouble. My own view is that the economic reactions to Brexit and what it means for the long-term fate of the British economy sort of hasn't happened yet, and is likely to happen, if at all, on a sort of deferred timetable. So I can actually envisage circumstances, surprising though it might be so this evening, that the Conservatives get themselves into a kind of cul-de-sac where the country sort of say, for heaven's sake, can people please kind of get their act together and act like adults and do what's right for the country. And that's why I floated the idea that, you know, don't discount that there might be an appetite in the coming years for a government of national unity, bringing Liberal Conservatives, Liberal Democrats, some Labour people together to try and kind of put the country back on the track after what I view as the kind of dead end into which we are hurtling now under the Conservatives.
Is there any way back from the Brexit vote? Could it be overturned?
It could only be overturned if people's opinions change significantly. And I don't think there's any reason to suggest that people's opinions should have changed in any material way between the 23rd of June and now, because I don't think people's views will, you know, people who voted Brexit will change their minds in any big way unless two things happen. And one is, of course, something that I don't want to wish on anybody. But one, of course, is if they feel that their own economic circumstances and that of their families are being affected by Brexit. But the other one is the one I alluded to earlier, is they just think that the government is making a total hash of Brexit. And that, you know, since no one ever bothered to spell out to people what Brexit meant, I suppose there might come a moment people will say, well, hang on, that's not what I meant. What I meant was, you know, 350 million quid for the NHS, you know, changes in immigration. What I didn't mean was yanking the United Kingdom, you know, hook, line and sinker out of the single market, which is where I think this government will end up. Because it's a hard Brexit is, the, in my view, the inevitable and unavoidable consequence of their own logic. Because they see the Conservative, it's like the two parts of the Conservative brain. One part of the Conservative brain says the priority for a great trading nation like the United Kingdom is to continue to have access to major export markets on our doorstep, namely the single market. But you cannot have access to that single market if you don't abide by the rules of that market. Because, you know, for those, all of you will know that here, the single market has nothing to do with tariffs. It's a body of, well, you know this better than anybody, it's a body of law, it's a body of rules, which, by the way, was created, of course, under British leadership, because it was a great insight from Lord Cofield and Margaret Thatcher that modern trade is impeded not so much by levies and taxes and tariffs, but by what they call in the jargon non-tariff barriers, everything from the technical requirements for your electric plug through to the qualifications required for lawyers to practice in one country to another. And you cannot, it is an you can't negotiate your way around this. You cannot, on the one hand, have access to that market and then say you're not going to obey by the rules of that market. And I think, since Theresa May and Philip Hammond, much though I think privately they would probably opt for the kind of maximum access to the single market option, they'll never get that past their party, never. Because you'd have to admit, if you did that, to a catastrophic loss of sovereignty.
But don't you think that, given that 48% would remain, and a significant chunk of leavers, certainly not the majority, but a chunk of the leavers are sort of liberal leavers of some form or another and still want quite close relations. Don't you think there's a majority in the country in favour of some soft form of Brexit? And isn't that the kind of thing that, if, let's say, the Liberal Democrats are perhaps a sensible opposition party, if that was being articulated, then that would put more pressure on the government and perhaps enable May and Hammond and other people in the government to actually put that sort of forward and take on Davis and Fox and Johnson and Leadsom and some of the more hard Brexiteers.
Yeah. I think the problem is, I mean, look, I would, if I was in charge, which I'm self-evidently not, I would advocate as a very suboptimal, but nonetheless the only available second best option would be some sort of Norwegian style arrangement where in effect the trade-off is that you're not a part of the European Union, but you nonetheless have pretty untrammeled access to its single market. But it comes with a huge cost, not only a financial cost, but much more importantly than that, it comes with a cost of lost sovereignty. And that's why I don't think that's possible. I just don't think you can conceivably
restrictions on the free movement of people.
Well, it has some restrictions, you know, at least in theory. But just on that, my own view is that with political will and a goodwill and a bit of diplomatic sort of, you know, fancy footwork, I reckon you could reconcile some kind of amendments on freedom of movement as it applies to the United Kingdom and access to the single market. You know, other politicians across Europe, I've spoken to a lot of them over the summer, they're not stupid. They've got pressure in their own countries on immigration and this whole cluster of identity issues. Of course you could imagine a circumstances in which the rest of the European Union says, okay, we'll have an emergency break which applies to the whole of the EU and to the UK. And now, UK, you've got what you want. Now please play ball as far as the single market is. You know, you could imagine that. So I don't think that's where the irreconcilable problem lies. The irreconcilable problem lies in the Tory party and in this government and in this parliament, which is there's no way that Theresa May could ever get a sensible, if suboptimal, second best option, Norwegian style arrangement through, because everyone would quite rightly say, well, hang on a minute, this is a loss of control. Now, of course, that was exactly the argument of Remainers. So I'm not sure if there's a neat way of squaring the circle. But the difference that I would highlight a little more forcefully than the sort of 48-52 is the generational one. You know, I just start from a kind of very basic, simplistic feeling that any country that takes a major decision about its own future against the explicit and stated wishes of those who have to inhabit that future, the young, is on an unsustainable path. So my hope is more that almost the passage of time and the realisation over time that there isn't a sort of neat, perfect utopia outside the European Union, which we keep all the good bits and discard all the bad bits. Hopefully, you know, the kind of younger generations just become ever more restive about how inadequate that is. But so I kind of think if there is ever any change of mind, it'll probably be quite a long time in coming.
So I can't imagine, let's say, your party's in favour of a second referendum.
Yeah.
I mean, you can. I doubt very much we're going to have a second referendum, but my concern about a second referendum is, let's say, you know, the package deal ends up being put, or the new Brexit settlement ends up being put to the public. What if it gets rejected? And then you're in a situation where the majority has voted to leave the EU, but not this form of leaving the EU. So you're still committed. We're still committed to leaving the EU, but it's not this form. What happens next?
No, I think what Tim Farron's quite rightly said is, look, given that no one was told what Brexit means, and given apparently that still no one knows what Brexit means, it's quite right that having sort of departed in a Brexit direction, once it finally becomes clear what Brexit is, what the destination is, that should be put to the British people. So it's not a second referendum, and it's not just mimicking the first referendum, it's just saying, OK, now we know what it means. Is it now something you want? But clearly, if the British people were to reject at that point, you default to membership.
Isn't the economy doing quite well since 23rd of June? In fact, falling pound has meant we've got an extra 400 students here at the LSE. We're quite happy about this. I mean, isn't it great for the British economy, the falling
Brexit
pound?
Hasn't happened.
Let's open it up for some questions. I think that we've got some roving mics. This chap here, about five rows up. Do you want to say your name and who you are? And keep your question short, please. We'll gather about three.
Yeah. My name is David Hadari. I'm an alumnus here. Your former coalition partner, David Cameron, has been getting a lot of flack over the last couple of days for his bombing campaign in Libya, for which you also voted. Do you think this... Well, I'd like to hear your opinion on the government report into the fostering of a safe haven for ISIS. You know, do you agree with it? What's your view on it?
Libya. Okay, let's take... this guy looking very eager over there.
Hi, my name is Amir from Casual Politics. Do you think that if Jeremy Corbyn gets re-elected next week as Labour leader, it would be good news for your party? Because according to your leader, Tim Farron, a lot of Labour MPs, along with a lot of Conservative MPs, disaffected Conservative MPs, will come and join your party to revive liberalism and also bring back a lot of disaffected liberal voters who deserted the party at the last general election. Thank you.
Let's take. Well, I can't, come on, women in the audience, put your hands up so I can see. The one right at the front here.
Sorry. This is a slight change of subject. You're an old boy. I'm a graduate of Minnesota.
Sorry?
I'm a graduate of Minnesota.
Yeah.
And you're kind of an old boy, Minnesota, which is, as you've stated, it's a very liberal state. It's a very liberal area, and we sort of get spoiled living there. And what is your take on what's going on in the States with this election?
Right.
So, Livia, Corbyn, U.S. politics, small topics here. Okay.
So on Libya, I haven't read the Foreign Affairs Select Committee report, which is what, sorry, the sound system's a bit funny, I couldn't quite hear that, but I think you can hear yourselves better than I can hear you, if you see what I mean. I think you're alluding to the Foreign Affairs yes. Select Committee report. I haven't read it, so I've only read the reports of it, but I think it is a very, very fair criticism to be made of David Cameron, and of course myself as well, and the government that took the decision at the time, that there was not nearly enough thinking which went into, you know, kind of what would happen next, planning. Now, ironically, I have heard people say, you know, why did they not learn the lesson from Iraq? And here's the cruel irony. But this partly happened because we were trying to learn the lessons from Iraq. So Iraq, you know, the kind of orthodoxy was, don't put boots on the ground, don't try and run a country, don't then sort of try and sort of, you know, mastermind how the different political forces are engineered. You know, people now say the de-Ba'athification of Iraq was a massive mistake by Paul Bremer, the then US administrator in Iraq. In other words, all the orthodoxy was, the lesson to be learned from Iraq is, if you're going to intervene, try and intervene with the lightest possible footsteps, and then don't try and play God with how a country organizes itself. And so the intervention was, as you know, taken. It was an airborne intervention. It wasn't like Iraq at all. And it was with an explicit aim to stop, and that was the catalyst for it, to stop Gaddafi and his forces slaughtering the entire population of Benghazi, which he was threatening to do at the time. So there was a kind of very powerful humanitarian motive to do it. But, of course, what I suspect this report has quite rightly now pointed out is that even if you think you're kind of intervening but without the kind of, you know, heavy footprints that happened in Iraq, you still have a responsibility to kind of try and work out what happens next. So there's, you know, there is no such thing as kind of, how can I put it? I can't think of a better way of putting it. Sort of in-out intervention in which you don't carry a responsibility for what happens next. And I think that is a perfectly legitimate criticism to be made. But my point is, it's being cast, I think, as a sort of, didn't they learn the lesson from Iraq? If anything, it's a failing because of the lesson we thought we were learning from Iraq, if I can put it like that.
Corbyn,
well, I think he is going to win by the sounds of it. Yeah, look, I mean, in one sense, of course, and Tim Farron is absolutely right, that of course, given that the Labour Party appears to have completely given up playing its sort of constitutional role as an opposition to this government, it's not only an opportunity, it's a sort of duty on the Liberal Democrats to try and do so instead. But I mean, I have to say, I mean, I have to confess, I just think it is really quite sad what's happening to Labour, because I'm not sure if they realise quite how boring it is to everybody else to listen to this. That sounds more facetious than it is, but it's just kind of like, you turn the news on and just like, all these people, it's like opening a door to a kind of family that's having this row about something. You don't quite know what it's about. And they're throwing the cutlery and the sauces and, you know, oh my God, they hate each other. And they talk this language you don't know. You just want to shut the door and go, oh, please, just can't you just sort it out? I don't understand all these distinctions between all these different Labour people. I don't care. I do care massively that the Labour Party has just left the pitch such that this, I think, illegitimate and incompetent government is getting away with things that it shouldn't. That's why it saddens me. And it irritates me immensely that Corbyn and the people around it appear just not to be interested in politics as something which has practical consequences. They appear to think that politics is all about striking poses, making yourself feel good about it, writing great terms, yelling this, promising a utopia tomorrow. You know, dare I say it, in a place like the LSE, that's fine if you're in academia. It's fine if you... don't take that personally. What I mean is that... you know, talking about stuff but not doing stuff
is what you do if you're
It's what Nick Clegg says, an expert.
Let me be less insulting and more serious. I believe, and I talk about this in the book, that politics is a deeply flawed, sometimes grubby, tough business, but it's the marriage of high ideals with the imperfect practice of trying to get stuff done. And if you're not interested in getting stuff done, why go into politics? It was partly my answer to the coalition. If you've got the opportunity to do stuff, why would you not do it? Because otherwise, you know, that's why I sideswipe in academia. Otherwise, yeah, academia or religion or single issue part of campaign groups, that's all fine. Politics, democratic politics and a representative democracy is about trying to translate these high ideals and these values into things that really make a difference, whether it's tax policy, education policy, and so forth. And it really frustrates me that one of the great parties in British politics appear now to be run by people who don't really want to do anything. And in many ways, my book is partly an attempt to try and resuscitate the battered, tarnished image and reputation of the imperfect art of doing things in politics. I guess that's part of the motives for writing this book.
So,
and then the next
politics,
one.
Yeah. Well, should we live in fear of President Trump?
I don't know. You'll be able to tell everybody much better than I will what's going on. But clearly there is the level of anger and disaffection on which Trump is drawing does have something in common with the populisms that we're seeing, you know, in Europe as well, whether it's Le Pen in France, left-wing populism in Podemos in Spain, Geert Wilders in the Netherlands. I mean, it does seem to be part of this sort of family of populisms, which, as I said earlier, is gaining enormous currency amongst millions and millions of our fellow citizens who, understandably, are furious because, and I personally think, you cannot overstate the significance of what happened in 2008. As an explanation for Trump. I don't think Trump would be, anywhere where he is now if 2008 had not happened. But I think this kind of near-death experience in our financial system, which has left many, many people with their own economic circumstances sort of grievously damaged, where a lot of people haven't had a meaningful wage rise for close to 8 years now, and they feel the elites haven't listened, no one's, especially here, even more so in the States, no one's been thrown into jail, no one's been, held accountable for that mistake. I think that just creates such an understandable rage with the status quo. And when someone like Trump comes along, I kind of get why it's such a seductive thing.
But isn't also this kind of slow burn of globalization, I mean, with Piketty kind of logging this growing economic inequality, and in Britain, growing geographic inequality, that it's not just post-2008. Yeah. This is a longer process that we still saw this with some of the poorest parts of the country in Britain, using this as a chance to say, nobody's listening to us. The Labour Party certainly not listening to them. The coalition government didn't listen.
So,
how do you address that the growing geographic, growing individual inequality in society?
By the way, I think on that, at least, it is a good thing that there appears to be a new emerging consensus that given that we now know that borrowing money is going to remain very, very cheap for a very long period of time for governments across the developed world, now is the time to embark upon major capital expenditure to renew the kind of public infrastructure of our societies. Now, that building lots of houses and railway lines and new roads and so on in and of itself doesn't solve some of these deep-seated social ills, but I think particularly on housing, it can go quite some way to doing so. But in the States, this complete dislocation, particularly on what's happened to people's wages as they're sort of working longer and longer hours to kind of tread water and receive the same amount of money, it clearly has come to kind of a boiling point now, and it means, as you know better than I do, that Trump doesn't operate by the same rules as any other politician. Because it doesn't matter whether he lies, it doesn't matter whether he changes his mind from one moment to the next, as long as he's giving expression and sort of emotional succour to that rage that people feel, that's enough. That's enough. And as I kind of explain in my book, I think it was ever thus, but it's become even more the case that emotion, and particularly visceral emotions like rage and anger and fear, they always trump. Sorry to...
That was not a deliberate... I wish it was a deliberate witticism. It wasn't, but they always use up, they always overwhelm the politics of rationality, of policy, and so on. So again, one of the challenges which I pose without providing a perfect answer in the book is that the politics of moderation and reason needs to somehow compete on the same emotional playing field with the populace. And that's very difficult, because the kind of the weapons of reason and logic and moderation and compromise just don't, they just don't kind of cut it when people are just feeling really, really, really angry and just want someone to sort of share their anger. And that's, you know, how we do that, how we compete on the same emotional level is one of the biggest challenges, I think, for the politics of moderation.
So let's have a few more questions. The woman in the middle here with the blonde hair.
Hello, my name's Camilla. I'm also an alumnus from the LSE. I was just thinking, despite the huge fractions that we know exist and which you've articulated today within the Conservative Party, they do often, at times of crisis, seem to give an impression of an extremely slick, well-oiled machine. Mm. You know, despite all the personality clashes, they seem to sort their house out unbelievably quickly following the referendum. Mm. And I think that gives people a feeling of reliability.
Yes.
I just wondered, having had the benefit of working closely with them in coalition, whether you have any views on, first of all, how they do that and whether there's any lessons that other parties can pick up from it, because it is effective.
Very good question. And this chap down here has been waiting very patiently. Yep, in the corner there.
Hi, Michael Climes. I'm a reporter for a trade publication, Professional Pensions. Could you please just talk a bit about Steve Webb and the reforms that he sort of introduced or helped introduce, auto-enrolment and the state pension?
You're kidding. I can't talk about pensions this evening. No, I mean, yeah, go on.
Well,
no, because that's just way beyond my knowledge, but go on, yeah.
Well, do you think that, can you just, you introduced auto-enrolment, you know, during, you know, a recession, you could argue getting people to save when belts are tight was quite maybe a radical social policy. I was just wondering if you could speak about that, and do you think that maybe it might be a positive part of your legacy? Do you think it will last?
Oh, right.
Do you get points?
And the final question here, there's a woman three rows back there. Yep.
Thank you very much. Katie Zorro from St. Paul's Girls' School. With your hope of the revival of the party, what can the Liberal Democrats do to regain the trust of the British students?
Mm. Okay. So, Camilla, I mean, I think your characterisation is right. The sort of remarkable the ruthlessness with which the Conservatives circle the wagons and make sure that their astonishing instinct for self-preservation prevails is quite something to behold. And, you know, they are, like it or not, and I don't, they are the you know, probably the most successful party anywhere in the democratic world. I think the explanation for it is you've got to understand a Conservative, that's what I learnt when I govern with them, they're not driven by an idea or by an ideology. They're driven by power. And it's power first and foremost. They have to be in charge. For what reason? To do what? All of that comes next. So everything is made subservient to power. And it means, and you're quite right, I was just fascinated time and time again, that when Cameron would come under pressure, they kind of realised that to hold on to power, they had to kind of protect the head honcho. So they'd circle the wagons, someone else would take the hit, someone else would take the blame, they'd create some great conflagration somewhere in the political jungle to distract people. They were brilliant at kind of protect. Of course, in the Lib Dems, you know, I mean, I don't say this complainingly, but it kind of like, if someone would say something beastly about us, everyone would go, ooh, maybe they're right. Maybe that's right. Maybe we are truly ghastly. You know, it's sort of, it's a completely different mindset. You know, they if someone attacked them, they would just attack back. They didn't think about it. We'd sort of stop and have some great seminar about it. It was just a sort of hopelessly herbivorous response to their much more sort of carnivorous response. And you get it in the Labour Party as well. You see it in the Labour Party now. There's nothing the Labour Party likes more than
arguing with each other. And so what the Tories understand, that, like, in a way that no other party does, which is, you know, when you're under pressure, don't start arguing amongst your paper over the cracks and so on. But that does not mean, that does not mean that this fundamental distinction between a part of the conservative brain, as I say, that kind of hankers after kind of 19th century Britain, and another part of the brain that kind of is much more reconciled with the kind of 21st century realities of a globalised world, is not under huge strain and needs to be resolved one way or another over Brexit. And in an odd kind of way, all we've seen over the summer is the sort of, as you say, the kind of traditional spasm of the Tory organism protecting itself after the referendum. But the dispute has only been deferred. It has only been deferred. But it has to come for the reasons that I explained earlier.
But one thing in the book on this that I found really fascinating was the tales you tell of the influence of the kind of conservative vested interests.
Yeah.
And the influence. So, you know, is that a... They want to stay in power, not just to stay in power, but they want to stay in power partly to protect those vested interests.
Yeah, yeah. It's a failing. In politics, it is right to sort of try and look after as much as you can and properly represent those interests, if I can put it like that, that are supporting you. And we didn't, clearly we didn't, because, I mean, it's extremely difficult to do so at the best of times. It's extremely difficult to do so at a time of fiscal restraint, because we had, in one shape or form, become quite popular amongst particularly the sort of a more kind of educated white-collar part of the kind of public sector and indeed university communities and so on. And we were always bound to sort of blot our copybook with them as we were introducing changes on public spending. But of course, with tuition fees and so on, we kind of put salt into the wounds. And the naivety, if I can put it that, of us, was that we sat there seeing it all through the prism of policy. If you get Lib Dems together, they just talk constantly about policy. You know, local government finance reform, this constitutional tweak. Lib Dem, the Tories, you get them together, they just talk about power. And which policy is necessary to be assembled to keep that power? You know, so power comes first, and we do sort of policy first, and then end up losing power. They do power first, and then they try and find the policies for it. But as Simon quite rightly said, yes, there are occasions when, for instance, we were saying, which I think most people would agree was patently right, which was, as a contribution to deficit reduction, we should ask people who have benefited from a massive inflation in the asset prices of very, very expensive properties to pay a small levy to contribute to deficit reduction. And privately they said, we've got no argument with this as a policy. There's no conservative argument against that. It's actually a perfectly good conservative argument for it. But we won't do it because our donors don't like it, so no. And so, self-evidently, one of the lessons I would suggest to anyone who tries to do what the Liberal Democrats did in the last coalition is, yeah, sort of look after your own interests, perhaps, more aggressively than we did.
Policy wonkery.
Sorry, I recoiled in horror at the idea of responding to... But every time Steve talked to me about pensions, I thank my lucky stars that I basically knew he knew what he was talking about, and I didn't really need to show him that I did. And he, I think, was honestly one of the most successful ministers in the coalition government. I mean, he single-handedly has revolutionised the pensions landscape. Auto-enrolment, the single consolidated citizens' pension, the change in the retirement age, and so on. And he's put it on a fairer and more sustainable basis in a way that countless people predicted was impossible to do. It's a historic achievement. And as I joke with Steve, you know, statues should be erected to sort of Professor Steve Webb up and down the country, because he has done more than anyone else I know to try and put a very unsustainable pension system on a more sustainable footing. But as you clearly will know better than I do, that doesn't mean we're out of the woods. We still have a pension system where the costs of which fall too heavily on the working age population, and where those costs, of course, are going to gallop in the years ahead because of another Liberal Democrat reform, which was the triple lock guarantee, which guarantees that the people's pensions increase by either inflation or earnings or 2.5% or whichever one is higher. Now, I personally think and this will make me immensely unpopular with some of my colleagues, but I personally think it is now going to be such an expensive policy to fulfil this thing, because, you know, inflation is not going to go higher than 2.5%, so it's going to have to be 2.5%, 2.5%, 2.5%. You know, 2.5% in a prolonged period of low inflation, which people hadn't anticipated, though that might, of course, change now after Brexit, is a hugely expensive thing to ask the working population to do for the retired population. So I would be open at, yes, maybe keeping a triple lock, but maybe adjusting the 2.5% bit of it, because I just think that's just kind of asking too much of the working age population. And more generally, you know, we have a huge problem between the generations. There are two big assets you build up over your life, property and pensions. And by and large, in this country, we have an unsustainable situation where those two assets are hoarded by the older generations and not made available enough and accessible enough to the younger generations, and that needs to change. I mean, I cite in the book some of the terrifying statistics of what's happened with property assets now. You know, I think I'm right in saying that only 18%, I need to check, but only 18%, you'll have to read the whole book to find it, the only 18%, and buy it, only 18%, I think, of all property assets in this country are owned by people under the age of 50. And that's just not, you can't carry on. So I think we need a kind of new suggestion I make in the book. You need a kind of new deal between the generations. And I think Steve would be ideally placed to design it.
Which is a nice segue into the final question about generations.
Trust. I think we just need to, perhaps more than everything else, I mean, of course, I can, most especially, and I've been invited to do it again this evening, go over and over and over and over and over and over and over again in the past and try and explain. That's part of it. But the most important thing is that, you know, the Liberal Democrats are now free, and I think Tim Farron has been doing this brilliantly, has been free to kind of rediscover our zeal as a party of reform, as an insurgent party of reform. That is what liberalism is. Liberalism is not a sort of comfortable philosophy of the status quo. It's a restless philosophy that believes that improvement can constantly happen through change. Liberalism doesn't sort of sit on its laurels and think that everything is okay. And actually, I found it myself. I left government after 5 years, much more anti-establishment sort of in instinct than I was when I entered into government in the first place. And I think that will, I hope, build bridges with younger voters who were disappointed with some of the things that have happened in recent years. And it's, by the way, it's starting to happen already. We're winning remarkable victories, chalking up remarkable victories in sort of local by-elections, which happen, you know, slightly below the radar screen every week. Well, just last week in Sheffield, where I'm an MP, I was out canvassing there 10 days ago. We won a local ward by-election where we'd come fourth last year. We leapt for, there was a swing of, I think, 25% in our favour. These are little straws in the wind. I'm not pretending, you know, I'm not going to pretend we're going to sort of snap back to former glories overnight. But I think there is such volatility in British politics, and there are such profound tensions, some of which we've talked about this evening. I think with the kind of gusto that Tim Farron is bringing to the job, I like to think that we can speak for many, many young people who want to see a better future with real kind of force in the years ahead.
We've got time for one more round of questions. I see the woman up there about halfway back.
Thanks a lot. Now I understand, Ines von Weitershausen, I'm a member of faculty here, and I understand that over the course of the summer you've been speaking to quite a lot of your European counterparts about Brexit and its consequences. Now, based on these conversations, could you give us a little bit of an overview of where you see specific countries stand? Who do you consider potential allies of Britain on specific issues? Who do you see as the more controversial partners? What is your overview on that? Thank you.
The views, gentleman down here, the glasses.
Sachin Patel, LSE alumnus and endangered species, Lib Dem member still. You've mentioned a couple of
growing
times
species, not endangered.
You've mentioned a couple of times today, and also I think in the interview with The Times, that, you know, smaller parties get hammered across Europe in recent history when they go into coalition. Is that something you can see resolving itself, or, you know, is the only solution, you know, you go for a more broad brush agreement, or is it something that comes with the growth of, you know, young voters, essentially?
Hi, my name is Rubina. I work for the NHS. I wanted to know what your thoughts were on the junior doctors contract and the strikes, and with the possible privatisation, what you think the Lib Dems can offer in terms of rectifying the issues with the NHS, especially in light of Brexit.
Sorry, the last bit.
Potential privatisation of the NHS.
Yep. And junior doctors strikes.
Brexit on the NHS and junior doctors.
Yeah, your thoughts on that.
Okay.
Right.
I'm afraid I can't give you a sort of scientific dissection of opinions because it was a sort of random set of discussions with particularly friends in the Netherlands and Spain and France, which is what I happen to know. I tell you what has struck me more than anything else, and it's really struck me, is that even very, very Anglophile politicians elsewhere, you know, as you might know, my mum is Dutch, so I know a lot of sort of Dutch politicians and so on. An incredibly Anglophile country. I'm not sure if there are any Dutch people in the audience, but, you know, I know friends of mine who are in Dutch politics who read the British press more carefully than I do, and who speak English probably better than I do as well. And, you know, they were really disheartened, because they'd always looked to Britain. There was a sort of affinity with Britain as a free, you know, open, free trading country, small L liberal countries. And I think the most striking thing that I have encountered this summer is that even amongst those people, they say very clearly and very firmly, look, be under no illusion, when push comes to shove, the existential priority for us right now is not to sort of cut some sweetheart deal with Britain, but is to make sure that what remains of the European Union doesn't unravel. And everything else will be subservient to that, which is why this ludicrous and sort of silly and sort of superficial and intellectually lazy stuff you get from commentators and the Brexit politicians, BMW want to sell us cars, so they'll make sure that they'll give us exactly what we want while they keep all the bad stuff. It's just like, it's much bigger than that. And part of the reason why the British political and media, and Simon has written very much more sophisticated way than I ever could about this, you know, one of the reasons why the British political and media elite has always misunderstood and misread political intentions elsewhere in the EU is because for other European Union countries, European integration is much more bound up with their sort of sense of identity. If you're German, Dutch, French, Italian, so on, it was, you know, the creation of the European community was an act of peace after war. If you're Portuguese, Spanish, Greek, and so on, it was above all a symbol of democracy after fascism. For us, we kind of shuffled into it with a sort of shrug of the shoulders and, oh well, if you can't beat them, join them sort of thing. No, seriously, we always had a much more lightly held affinity with our European vocation. And that's why I think we are, once again, at risk of misunderstanding. That they're not sitting around saying, oh, yeah, French wine growers, they'll be worried about that. It's not going to be a pocket calculator negotiation. This is about quite visceral things to do with whether the European Union is going to survive at all. And we just are not their priority for that reason. And I think the sooner we kind of realise that, the better. I don't have the neat answer to that one, because the pattern is, I'm afraid, is near universal. Jim Wallace, who led the Liberal Democrats in a successful coalition with Donald Dewar in Scotland, is an exception. Joschka Fischer, I was with him in Berlin yesterday. He was an exception when the Greens, but pretty well everybody else. Sweden, pretty well, no. They go through the cycle of getting D66 have made it sort of turn it into an art form. They go into government on a wave of popularity. Absolutely happened. The last time they left government, they got, I think, about 2.5% of the vote. And now they're riding high in the polls again. They're literally this yo-yo. FDP, obviously, finally it's caught up with them. The Labour Party in Ireland recently is probably the best parallel. The Labour Party, centre-left party, went into a coalition with Enda Kenny, centre-right party at a time of fiscal austerity. They did lots of brave things, good things. Absolutely killed. They didn't do tuition fees. None of these other parties did tuition fees. So I'm afraid I resort to sort of hopeless psychobabble in my book when I try and explain this. And I even sort of resort to my sort of undergraduate social anthropology because I remember when I did anthropology, the structural anthropology, those anthropologists amongst you will know this, or Claude Levi-Strauss and all the rest of it, was based on this idea that there's something in our brain that kind of likes dividing things in twos, clean, unclean, sacred, profane, good, evil, male, female, right, left, up, down, and things which interfere with that really kind of annoy us. So maybe smaller parties just kind of annoy the mental map that prefers settled. I don't know. I honestly, but we have to work out a way to ensure that for smaller parties, coalition isn't an act of political harikiri, because it is going to happen again. It is going to happen, and there's no way that British politics is just going to, you know, go back to the 1950s where everyone voted either for the red team or the blue team. So I'm afraid I venture some answers in the book that you must now buy and read. but I don't think I have the neat answer. If you have it, please tell me. On the NHS, I mean, I'd say I personally think that the junior doctors were right the first time round when they went on strike, demanded changes, and then said that those changes were the ones they could live with. I have a great deal of sympathy with junior doctors who feel that they're being asked to sort of fulfil impossible tasks, and that Jeremy Hunt is treating them, you know, with a tin ear and all the rest of it. I just think they're going to exhaust public patience a little more quickly than they think if you start having 3, 4, 5 day strikes over differences which now are quite difficult for the public to follow, and where quite a lot of the big disagreements and demands of junior doctors were actually met, and, as you know, actually accepted by the junior doctor negotiator. So if I was a junior doctor, I probably would have been one of those who said, right, we've won, let's now bank this. That's what I would have done, but I totally understand why. Look, on the NHS, this is not the time to talk about the NHS. I personally think this kind of refrain that the great threat to the NHS is mass privatisation, I just don't think it's just not what's going to happen. It's not what might happen. It's not what can happen. It's not what is in. I just don't think that's the problem. I think the problem, and we've seen a lot of it actually in some of the news today, is a social care system on its knees. I mean, just almost at breaking point, so that we've now got excessive rates of hospitalisation, particularly of older people with repeat complications, who, once those complications are successfully treated in hospital, can't leave hospital. And so we have this conveyor belt of an ageing population being decanted into hospitals, and we don't have the mechanism by which they then can be cared for in their homes or their community. And it's proving to be incredibly expensive, and it's, of course, very bad for the health of the population as well. We have an almost grotesque, if unwitting, discrimination against people with mental health problems as opposed to physical health. So personally, I think the crises in the health system are much more about the way we haven't worked out what to do with an ageing population and age-related conditions. And we park people in hospital in a way that is both expensive and bad for their health. We have a social care system that desperately needs fixing, and a mental health system which is still treated in. That, for me, is much, much more worrisome. And it's very worrisome than some kind of cardboard cutout allegation that someone is going to try and mass privatise the NHS. The NHS, as you know, has always been a mixed economy. I mean, the GPs are private, self-employed. You know, I sometimes think people talk about the NHS as if it is some monolithic public entity. It isn't. GPs are self-employed, private sector employees, which have been, but they work for the NHS. My grandfather edited for years the British Medical Journal, and the medical world has always been a mixed economy. So I personally think it's more about mental health versus physical health, and the acute dilemmas of how to deal with an ageing population, which we haven't worked out as a society at all.
Well, thank you very much for such a stimulating evening, Mick.